This is Taiwan Bound, the English language podcast of Tel Aviv University. Please welcome your host, Ido Aharoni, Tel Aviv University's graduate, member of the Board of Governors, lecturer, writer, and veteran diplomat.
Welcome to yet another episode of Tao Unbound. I'm Ido Aharon, your host, and it is my distinct pleasure to have with us today Professor Yossi Shein.
It's a pleasure.
I should mention to our listeners and our viewers that Professor Yossi Shein is a superstar that Tel Aviv University produced. He's very well known in Israel, appears a lot in Israeli media, international media, writes a lot. His books are very popular, and he served for many, many years as a political science professor. He's now professor emeritus. He was the founder and the head of Tel Aviv University's School of Political Science, Government and International Affairs. He was the head of the Abba Ibn Graduate Studies Program in Diplomacy and the director of the Francis Brody Institute for Applied Diplomacy. He's also teaching at Georgetown University, the same area. Published several books, served in the Israeli Knesset from 2019 to 2022. And held several other very important positions in the Israeli higher learning establishment. It's such a pleasure to have you. I wish I had all the time in the world to read everything that is in your bio. But really, thank you for being here.
I'm very grateful.
Now, I see that you wrote a great deal about American politics, about religion in America, about this American right, the Israeli right. You wrote about corruption. You wrote about national security, Israel, diaspora ties. And so you are relevant to what is happening today from so many angles that it's incredibly exciting for me to have you here. So the first question that I have for you is actually personal. That's how we always start our podcast. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up doing what you're doing today.
I was born in Israel and was raised here in Israel. And eventually at one point in time, I started my studies after serving in the army and became more and more interested in the subject of philosophy and politics and history, and pursued my PhD eventually at Yale University in political science. And I became a professor in the United States and moved to Israel back. And in fact, since I came back to Israel, I was shuttling back and forth to the United States as well, eventually holding a dual appointment, two tenure positions in some ways, from 1999 at Georgetown University, where I established also the Center for Jewish Civilization. And in both places, I was a professor of government and international affairs and have written books, which I always thought should be related to what really happened in politics. And initially, when I started my work, and then even when I wrote my dissertation, I was trying to some degree to move away from Israel, where I grew up, where my passion was, not to be inflicted by the Israeli so-called bug that I was inflicted since I was a child, my Zionist leaning and so on, and just like remove myself. But it was always in the back of my mind as I was writing my books and doing my research. My initial research was on the subject of exile politics. I started studying the political exiles of our time, but went into antiquity and questioned the subject via the prism of theory by asking the question of how does it work when you are an opposition from abroad, delineating the lines of loyalties. Being abroad is oftentimes being depicted as an act of exit, an act of treason almost for some as exiles, and how they coalesce and work from abroad in order to perpetuate the condition which will bring them back home. These issues of exile kind of informed my thinking for quite some time, and I had some nice success was my work in the United States. Eventually, I moved into some other subject related to questions of boundaries. I wrote two volumes, in fact, on the subject of interim governments, those who are coming after the collapse of an old regime and awaiting a new regime, especially in the move into democratic regime after authoritarian period. But not only. For example, also when there is a chaos, there is a failed state, and you need to have like an international interim government model that I created. And I traveled the world with this. And this book also, or these two volumes, became very important, some people say, in facilitating transitions to democracy from South Africa to the Czech Republic to places in Namibia and Cambodia. I was invited all over the world to talk about these things, and was in fact at times even part of the transitions themselves, as I was invited to present my work. In fact, even now, we're talking in April of 2024, people are consulting me about the possibility of a transitional authority in Gaza. What will happen? And I is known for this works as well. Eventually, I moved into the subject of diasporas in international affairs. Also, people who are not exiled in a political sense, but reside abroad, but still have an attachment to a country of origin or symbolic homeland via their families, via their emotions, or sometimes via their citizenship, etc. And this is very important subject in world affairs, because many people are kind of having dual identities or even transnational lifestyle in the era of the high-tech level. And I wrote a book about the Americans who have ties abroad, how they impact their country's life and, in fact, international affairs. And this was also highly debatable book in terms of how much people who are engaged in American foreign policy are marketing the American creed abroad, as I called my book. This book also got some attention, including from Hillary Clinton and others who wanted to see in the 1990s the role of diasporas in international affairs. And I advised also governments about their diasporas, how they can become a vehicle for exporting their views into America and vice versa, including on many issues of conflict resolution, on religion, on issues pertaining to economy, with remittances, with investments, and so on and so forth. And the Israeli example always, as I said, in my back of my mind. So I've been dealing with Israel as well, because I was, of course, teaching in Israel, going back and forth. But only after the Second Intifada, I started really delving deeply into the Israeli politics and the Israeli situation, and wrote some major works also on Israel. And I will not give you all my books right now, but lots of works which are related to Israel, its founding, its legacy, its role, and of course its ties to the Jewish world.
Yeah, and I should mention the famous book that you wrote, the Israeli Century, in which you make the argument you mentioned the relationship between diaspora and the symbolic homeland, and that's about that relationship.
My latest book, in fact, The Israeli Century is a massive book. I worked on it for 6 years. Came out in America recently by Simon Schuster, and now coming France and in Hebrew, and basically trying to see what happened to the Jews when sovereignty informs most of their life. As we see, the State of Israel is now becoming the most important, let's say, feature of Jewish life in the world, while for generations and millennia, the Jews were, of course, exilic and diasporic, as I wrote before. But now sovereignty is informing their life. And what does it do to Judaism itself, to the trajectory of Jewish life, to the issues of security, to the issues of what we call Jewish values, to the issues of Jewish religion, and to the entire world itself, to other religious denominations. So I've dealt with this in my latest book called The Israeli Century.
By the way, I'm intrigued by the gap that exists between the perception of Israelis about the position of diaspora Jews, for example, and the reality, which you know well and I know well because I spent so many years in the States like you did. American Jews, for example, were never Zionists.
Some, of course, were very Zionists, and the Zionists...
A small minority.
Not so small. Many people in America have become Zionist, and the Zionist movement in America, of course, which was led by Judge Brandeis, and of course his idea that to be a good American, you have to be a Zionist in many ways, or to be a good Jew, to be a good American, to be a good Jew, to be a good Jew, you have to be a Zionist. This is a mantra still exists. And in fact, as you look at American Jewry, which kind of like started to organize their life and communities and their attempt to retain their ethnicity, their identity, Israel became, after the 67 war mainly, a major feature of their identity, especially in the organizational behavior, because they were dissipating in America in an ethnic level, those who are not religious. So they have kind of like adopted Israel and Israeli nationalism as a beacon of retaining their own Jewish American identity. And this happened also to people who, or to organization, who initially either were indifferent to Zionism or even totally rejected it, you know, with the reform movement and other progressive, but eventually adopted it. Now, in fact, as we speak, and this is 2024, and after the October 7th trauma of the Jewish people, many have started to question this kind of identity, what happened and so on. So this is a very lingering issue about the centrality of Israel in the life of Jews, or perhaps some people want to remove themselves, or maybe say it's too much affecting us, and also while dealing American Jews about their own identity from variety of schools of thought, from more religious and less religious, and with political orientations, as you now, well know.
Talking about American Jews, did you find any parallels between them and their relationship with Israel and let's say the Irish or the Italian Americans?
That's my contribution to the field. I'm one of those who is known as one of the founding figures in the field of diaspora politics in the world, and I've written several major works on that, in fact like four books on the subject, and I've dealt with diasporas from all over the world, from Armenia to India to the Irish to the Palestinians, to Latin Americans, you name it, I've been there, I've done it, and indeed, that's what I've done. I'm a scholar of diasporas in comparative perspective, and the Jewish model has always been a very important model for me, either to emulate or to study from, but I've done lots of work on diasporas and international affairs, including now lots of work with the Indian government, which called me and others who kind of like mobilize under Modi and the Janata parties and mobilize the Indians abroad as a vehicle for lifting India. Think about it, the 20% of the Indian GDP came from the diaspora. The diaspora, the Indian diaspora in America is the most successful immigrant community in the history of America, interesting enough, according to Forbes magazine. So many such diasporas I've dealt with in trouble.
And they're also very successful in South Africa, in many
places,
England.
In many places. So this is just one example which I dealt with in trouble and got recognition for.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. So in your assessment, what is the impact of 10/7? So you alluded to the fact that there are people that 10/7 cemented their emotional connection to whatever it is Israel represents in their eyes, and there are people who are questioning it. What do you think is going to be the impact on this very delicate relationship?
I think October 7th is a date it will be impacting the Jewish world, not only Israel, but the Jewish world in general, in infamy for life. This is a moment that we are now, we know we start to grasp it. We're only 6 months away from it. We saw early on after October 7th how quickly from empathy we turn into a wave of anti-Semitism that kind of like engulfed the entire Jewish world, especially in the West. You know, the majority of the Jews today outside Israel reside in the United States, and there are very few other communities that really are substantial, like in England or in France, where I sat and did lots of work in the past. So October 7th have shattered many of the views, the self-perception of the Jews as secure people in their sovereignty, undermined the concept that sovereignty grants security. And this is something which was the legacy of Zionism. And many people started to ask, okay, what's next? Also, the events of 2023 in Israel, the rivalries over the judicial reform, or judicial revolution, what the nature of the state will be. But undoubtedly, October 7th will have tremendous impact of the world Jewry. They've mobilized on the one hand, but also some of them felt that were not so, let's say, intensely connected, felt that they are vulnerable. And these vulnerabilities have existed in the past. One should not underestimate how the past. Also, we had some such issues after September 11th, or we had in Durban the anti kind of like Israel conference that was taking place in the same juncture of September 11 in 2001. But also because of, you know, like if we remembered 1975 when Zionism was identified in the United Nations. As racism, there are many junctures, but this is a major, major juncture. Just because the vulnerability of the Jewish state, which was unknown, and the catastrophe that basically befell on the state of Israel, that many people kind of describe second only to the Holocaust, something of a magnitude that we could not imagine. The Jews are being slaughtered and raped and killed massively in their own country without being prepared, while before everything was celebrating, or everybody was celebrating the tenacity, the strength, the resilience of the state. Here the state was, in fact, reflecting an image of weakness, of not preparedness, of lack of preparedness, and so on. So this is something that will follow us, aside from the geopolitical developments that are taking place. I don't want to make many predictions how it will be into the future, but undoubtedly it has reverberated greatly.
Now, when you look at the trajectory of Israel's evolution from 1948, and we're about to celebrate 76 years, so other than 10-7, as you go, we'll go down in history and infamy. What are the other turning points, important points? So 67 must be there.
There are many turning points, but there was a kind of almost a linear curve in back and forth, you know, with 67, with 73, with the war in Lebanon, all those junctures. But Israel has grown from a small country, which was in fact second to the diaspora. When Israel was born with 680,000 or 600,000 people in 1948, the American diaspora was the attraction, the golden Medina. This is what people were looking for. And Israel was kind of like a side story for the Jewish story of the 20th century after the Holocaust. America, the strength of America, the position of American Jewry, their visibility, their wealth, their cultural achievements, etc., etc., as opposed to Israel, which was trying to, put its roots as a sovereign state. But very quickly, things kind of like moved into the direction of Israel, with lots of issues that were pertaining to the Jewish people as a whole, including their memory, Israel is defining Jewish memory, don't forget, including on the issue of the Holocaust with the Eichmann trial. It was in Israel that it happened, including the question of the vision of Israel on the reading of history, nationalism in Israel, on the subject of the First Temple and the Second Temple. So Zionism in Israel started to redefine the past of the Jews as well. And of course, of religiosity, the dominance of the evolution of Israel religion, and orthodoxy, extreme orthodoxy and ultra-orthodoxy was kind of like weighing heavily on the diaspora. The diaspora became secondary to the Israeli life. October 7th kind of like gave us such a traumatic juncture in our life that will have to be somehow evaluated later into the future. Also because the diaspora itself had undergone within itself transformations from being a minority for being completely integrated, all the issues pertaining to what we call assimilation, intermarriages in the United States, and so on. So many issues are there that needs to be. And of course, the institutions, Israel representing the Jews, who speaks on behalf of the Jews, with what authority, only in Israel. There are very few who knows others who speak on behalf of the Jews, even role models of the Jews in the world. When I ask people in America, who is your Jewish role model in America? They barely know anyone. Bernie can name anyone. The last one they could name perhaps was Elie Wiesel with the memory of the Holocaust. But even then, you know, like no really role models. Israel has it. It has pros and cons, lots of problems, as we know. But this is yet to be seen how we will evolve from here.
Now, you spoke recently, a couple of years ago, about the Christian right in America and their relationship with Israel.
Yeah.
And I'd like to ask you, how can Jews who care and love Israel and support Israel reconcile, how can they reconcile the relationship that Israel is developing with the Christian right? And I should mention that it started over a century ago. So this is nothing new. The attraction of Christians to the concept of the ingathering of Jews in the Holy Land is not new.
Of course.
So how can they reconcile? And what are the sticking issues here? What's the problem here?
There are many. This is a big question, of course, on the relation of Christianity and this type of evangelical Christians to the Jews. To begin with, and we're talking about American evangelicals, you should know that they already in the 19th century, leaders of the evangelical were already Zionist in their orientation, anticipating sort of the Jewish return as a way of seeing it, influencing even Brandeis, Judge Brandeis. But see, the relation to Christianity in general is very, very important, what happened in the Jewish state. Keep in mind that historically speaking, the collapse of the Second Temple and the rise of Christianity eventually, especially its consolidation with the Catholic Church from the 4th century on, has created a theology whereby the Jews have already been replaced by Christians. And the replacement theory and the Jews were no longer Jews. To be Jewish is not Jewish in the flesh, but Jewish in the spirit. And this is the messenger that the Christianity, Catholic Christians have made. And the Jews were kind of remnants that the church itself said, "Al tehargum," don't kill them, because they're reminding us of the moment Jesus transformed Judaism itself. And the Jews were side story to history. They were truly side story to history after they went into exile. From time to time, manifestations of writing, of the Talmudic writing and so on. But by and large, they were really the side story of Christianity and later on of Islam. The replacement of Judaism by two major religious denominations, which has the same God, but with different interpretations, with different books also. In many ways, when Zionism came back on the podium of the world with Herzl, and Herzl goes to Pius X, the Pope, and asks him to recognize Zionism, he said, "How can we recognize Zionism? You never recognize our prophet. In fact, it will be a blasphemy." And indeed, the loss of sovereignty was perceived in Christianity as the sign that the Jews are not going back into history. The Jews themselves and the Zionists themselves always described the coming back as to coming to history, because Talmudic life or religious life was not part of history. They lived kind of like outside history. They never wrote history, in fact. They never wrote history. Jews never wrote history after Josephus Flavius' book on the Jews. They never wrote history until the 19th century. Only with the recovery of modernity they started to write history, and later on Zionist history. So for the Catholics, for example, the very idea of the establishing of a Jewish state, Israel, was very antithetical to their theology. And they refused to recognize it initially, don't forget. They started the recovery process with the Jews, with the Nostra Aetate, in the early 60s. And later on, only in the 1990s, they start to recognize the state of Israel, a move which was almost antithetical to the core. Only in 2014, when the current Pope came to lay a wreath on Herzl's tomb, then was kind of a break, because suddenly they recognized Jewish sovereignty, full, simple, and the right of the Jews to self-determination. At that time, when I spoke to people in the Council of Bishops, I remember one guy, his name was Father McManus, told me, "This move to recognize the Jewish state is the greatest move in the Catholic Church since the Reformation." It's a major shift in the theological. For the evangelicals, there was another story. The adoption of Israel and the love for the state of Israel was a moment that is should lead them into Armageddon, which is kind of like the historic fight that will eventually bring the second coming of Christ. So the Israeli state is harbingers of the second coming of Christ.
It's part of their theology.
Yes. I once asked Abe Foxman, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, I say, Abe, how can it be that you are such in good relation with the evangelicals, who in many ways, in the end of the day, will convert the Jews? So he said to me, Yossi, you know, we need allies. And when we come to the end of the days, we'll renegotiate. And so this we needed allies. You don't look at theology. They loved us. They are Zionist. And when Donald Trump moved the embassy to Jerusalem, you didn't see many Jews coming, but many evangelicals came. You didn't see liberal Jews because the administration was quite hostile to liberal Jews, whom they saw kind of like almost anti-Jewish. Think what Trump is saying about liberal Jews today in America. They don't love Israel. They're not loyal to Judaism. That's what he said. Interesting enough, the twists that you see in the language. And also from the Israeli right. The Israeli right for years was trying to say that the American liberals are drowning. They're not Jews anymore. They're trying to negate them. And even Makori Shon, the paper, wrote, American Jews, let them drown. Let them drown. And some people say, how can you say that? You know, our brothers and sisters are drowning, so to speak, and becoming integrated in America, and you don't going to send them, you're not going to go rescue them? This was the discussion. So there's lots of things happening in this business, and Israel has become a very important player in the theology of evangelicals in the United States.
Now, we don't know what kind of Israeli society will emerge out of 10-7, but let's assume, just for the sake of our discussion, because you're such an expert on this issue of diaspora politics and so on, let's assume that the Israel that would emerge from 10-7 will be more militaristic, more ethnocentric, more parochial, more theocratic, more messianic. How would that affect Israel's relationship with world Jewry, not just American Jewry, Canadian Jewry, British Jewry, Australian Jewry, South African Jewry, French Jewry, and so on?
Too many assumptions for me here. I cannot, look, I don't know if we will become more messianic. We are on the verge of a catastrophe in Israel now. And if we don't know how to navigate the ship, we can go into the abyss. That's the way I see it.
Please elaborate.
The October 7th kind of exposed a major nerve in Israel. But the nerve was there before, not in security. We saw 2023, how we were at each other's throats, almost leading to a civil war in Israel. One should not underestimate the enmity, the animosity, the rupture in Israeli society that leads us to really hate each other in many ways. And people warned, the president of Israel warned, many political leaders have warned. We saw what happened in the streets. October 7th was a trauma in our security, in our boundaries, and still continuing with what happened with Hezbollah, what happened now with Iran, and so on. But the question of how we will create a people, how we will establish the identity of Israel, Zionism itself undergone tremendous transformation. Zionism was a modern vision of the state, had kind of a more universal vision of Judaism, albeit nationalists. But nowadays, there are those who want to be much more parochial. There are, of course, all the ultra-Orthodox. Will they join the state or will they stay away from the state? And the so-called Israeli right, which is a weird term because the ultra-Orthodox are against nationalism and against the state. How can they be part of the right? But that kind of like terminologies of politics. So we are not sure how things will evolve. And things will have to take a shift in order to recreate what people are calling rebooting the state, maybe restart Israel. One cannot really imagine what will happen into the future, but we're in a risky moment because everything kind of like showed us that we're incredibly vulnerable, that our unity is not a sure thing, that our political echelon is incredibly weak and shattered and creating ruptures in our society, that religion has not been settled in Israel, that the relations of institution between the courts and the parliament and the government are far from being arranged. And all of this is in the midst of the Middle East, kind of like that felt that we are being ruptured. It is not by mistake that the Arabs attacked us. They saw how ruptured we are. And they attacked us. Our nemesis attacked us. And our friends started to question our viability, our democracy, where we are going, Israel. What is the vision? What is the subject? What is the story that Israel will tell? We are now crafting a new story. Hopefully it will be a hopeful story, a visionary story, something that will be a new kind of set of values that will lead us into the future. But I don't know where we're going to end up here.
Yeah, and it seems like, based on your description, that we're back to the old dilemma, whether we should see ourselves as victims of history or victors of history.
One of the things that is absolutely the case, you know, victimhood, which was kind of like a legacy of ourselves. You know, the Zionists didn't like victimhood. So we were trying to create kind of triumphant, the soldiers, the heroes, the heroism of the Bible was adopted over the Talmudic scholarship. David the hero, you know, like the Joshua, the Maccabees. We loved heroes, and the military was the heroes. And that's where we moved. All those religious guys who were studying, well, you know, like they kind of they were, for Ben-Gurion, they were a tourist attraction because they were remnants of the past. But suddenly remnants of the past becoming so powerful in the state, and the legacies are not yet settled. What will happen? So we are now really rewriting or trying to write, I don't know if rewriting, trying to write a new chapter. Hopefully will be a forward-looking chapter, because without modernity, the Jews would not look like what we are today. They would stay in antiquity, and Judaism would remain a sect, of religious sect in the diaspora. Some people cherish this idea that we were able to keep ourselves alive just because we were dedicated to the Torah. Perhaps we did, but our life was miserable. This was not a life of success and flourishing. Modernity brought success to the Jews. Modernity allowed the Jews to kind of like expand their abilities. Modernity brought the Nobel laureates, nothing else. Modernity brought the Zionist state, nothing else. So the question is, how do we reconcile between religion and modernity and the legal state and democracy and the vision of modernity and reconciling modernity and antiquity and how we work it out? We are far from settling this because our political structure is lousy. In many ways corrupt and lousy, governed by very, very low-level people. And the talent that we have here is immense. The social society, civil society is remarkable. And yet there is tremendous gaps also with streams in society that are not connected together. And the pioneer spirit of Israel is being debased or being dead, or we saw what happened now with the kibbutzim being under duress in an amazing fashion, sadly so.
Well, you know, we can have this conversation going on for hours because it's so fascinating. But I must ask you one last question. So you retired from political life. You retired from television.
I didn't retire.
You didn't retire.
I never entered.
You never entered.
I was summoned by Avigdor Lieberman to serve. I was never a politician. I never competed. It's not, people in America may think that I was running for office.
Right. You were asked to join a party.
In the parliamentary system, say, Yossi, will you join me? Yeah. And I said, sure, I will use it. You asked me in 2015, I couldn't. I was writing a book. I was the head of the school. Now I could. It was fascinating for me.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'll come again.
My question is, you just published a massive book. What's next for you? Tell us.
First of all, I'm doing lots of things. I'm now working with the president of Brandeis, who called me, and I'm assisting the president of Brandeis. I'm the liaison of Brandeis in Israel, trying to bring the Jewish life in America with Jewish life in Israel. And we have been done an incredible job in the last few years, including at Tel Aviv University, trying to combine the Brandeis legacy of American Zionism. And it's quite remarkable to see, even this week, you saw that the ADL is ranking American campuses along the lines of how they fight anti-Semitism. Brandeis ranked number one in fighting anti-Semitism. Brandeis is a Jewish school, has kind of lost its identity in some ways because only 35% are Jewish. And it became kind of like more sectarian, you know, and it's trying to recover. I got the president of Brandeis read my book and he called me. He said, would you
terrific,
come?
Terrific.
And I came and we're doing an incredible job with Israeli universities above and beyond, of course, Tel Aviv University, with Israeli academia. I'm doing lots of things in Europe. I was the representative of the Knesset in the European Parliament and many other things that I do. But I'm far from retiring in official. I retired kind of like as an emeritus to give myself time to do other things.
Well, it seems like you've never been busier.
I wouldn't say
we
that,
thank
but
you.
I've been, I'm okay.
We thank you for coming and spending some time with us. And we'd like to ask you to give us permission to invite you again.
Permission is granted.
Thank you so much. And to our viewers and listeners back home from Tel Aviv, goodbye until our next episode.